This is videotape number 23, Key Legal Implications of Computer Network Defense.
A worm that will work its way back through the internet to identify who the hacker is. It will not cause, or it's not intended to cause, any harm at all, anywhere. It is only intended to track your attacker and to identify who he or she or it, the state perhaps, may be. Is that lawful under U.S. domestic law for you to use that? Is it lawful under international law? Is it lawful under foreign law? Is it unlawful? I have a lot of people say no. Is it unlawful under all circumstances? Is there anyone that can use it as a tool? Perhaps the FBI, maybe. Maybe the national security community. Could the use of that worm provoke hostilities? Could it be considered a demonstration of hostile intent or hostile act? Could it cause conflict between two countries? Could it cause you to go to jail? Could it cause your corporate officers to go to jail? Could it cause any corporate liability? Well, a lot of people are nodding in the correct direction this early in the morning, so that's a good sign. So I won't have as hard of a time this morning for the presentation. But instead of using the worm, you've identified some of the points, stepping off points along the way. So you call some of your buddies at those ISPs and some of these other companies, these service providers, and you ask them questions to look into their system for you to help identify who the hacker is that's attacking your system. May they release information to you? Must they release information to you? Must they release it to law enforcement? Or may they release it to law enforcement? That is a very complicated set of questions. The others were a lot easier. That is very, very complex under the Electronic Communications Protection Act. But you decide instead to use a honeypot, something a little bit more passive within your own system that you have control and authority over. Is that entrapment under U.S. law? You're not a government agent. Is that entrapment? It might be, depending upon what you're doing. Or it might just be considered something that you're not going to be able to prosecute, even though it's not entrapment. What if you identify who the hacker is? Can you fry their hard drive? Can you attack them with a distributed denial of service attack? Those are some of the kinds of questions that we're going to look at today. What if the hacker is Iranian law enforcement? You've identified the hacker, and it's Iranian law enforcement that is in your system looking for evidence of somebody who is violating Iranian law, breaking into one of their computers. Is it lawful for them to be there under international law? Is it lawful for them to be there under domestic law? Was it lawful for the FBI to go into the computer systems in Russia in the Invicta case several months ago, or actually last year when they did the penetration? Those are some of the kinds of interesting questions that we're going to talk about today. Next slide, please. What we'll start, if you look at about 10 o'clock and work your way around clockwise, what we're going to do today is we'll talk very, very quickly about the purpose of this presentation, and we'll define computer network defense. I have one slide from the Joint Staff definition of computer network defense. We'll look at the legal framework for response. How do you determine what law applies to what you want to do in cyberspace? And we'll look at it from several different perspectives to kind of give you a sense of how do you determine if international law applies, how it applies, does U.S. domestic law apply, does foreign law apply, and how might they impact the decision that you want to make. Now, we'll look at this for the private sector as well as from the government sector as to the activities. We'll look at some key legal issues, and we'll look at some selected legal authorities, and we'll do that from both a U.S. or from a U.S. domestic and international and foreign law perspective. We'll look at a very quick analytical decision support model, which is kind of my perspective of how an attorney would do a legal analysis of an activity that a company or a government is considering to engage in cyberspace. And then we'll look at some case studies and policy considerations and recommendations as to how we can better protect America's information infrastructure and perhaps work together without compromising our own security or compromising our proprietary information. And I'm not sure if the guy jumping is you because it's over or me because it's over, but we'll end up at the at the conclusion, of course. Next slide. Now, the purpose of this presentation is to, like I just said, to explore how we can better protect America's information infrastructure. This is equally applicable to any other country, but you know, I'm focusing on America's information infrastructure and will focus primarily on U.S. domestic law and will only discuss general principles of how foreign law will apply. But for you that are interested in it from another perspective, the U.S. domestic law is going to apply to any activity that you may be engaging in the U.S., whether you're physically here or not, and then how U.S. domestic law may impact you in your country is the same as how the foreign law may impact us or you here in the United States engaging in the same activities. But how can we protect our infrastructure, detect potential attacks by anybody, whoever they happen to be, and then respond effectively to protect our infrastructure and do so in a way that is in consonance with American democratic principles and international law. Next slide. Now, one quick warning, this is not intended to be legal advice for you. There are some very simple answers in this area. On the other hand, there are some very complex answers. Some of the U.S. domestic law can get very, very complicated, and the only way to really figure it out is to have a matrix and a chart and to really study and figure out what's happening. This is not intended to be legal advice in any way, but to kind of give you a context of what some of the issues are so you know when you should go and talk to your legal advisor or your general counsel before you do any particular activity. Next slide, please. What is computer network defense? There's quite a few definitions that are out there. My favorite definition is the joint staff definition, the military definition. And you'll see here that it's defensive measures to protect and defend information, computers, and networks from disruption, denial, degradation, and destruction. An interesting thing is how we defined information and information structures within the U.S. military is that includes people as well. Because part of the primary goal of information warfare and information operations is not necessarily to attack a machine, but to influence a decision maker into a particular course of action. Next slide. So let's look at the legal framework for responding to computer intrusions, and we're going to do this from three different perspectives just to kind of give you a sense of how the law applies and everything. Some of these graphics get a little intensive, and we're not going to go into a lot of detail because we don't have the time in an hour and 10 minutes to do so this morning. But if you look in your book, in case you're kind of sitting a long way, the presentation, the black and white copy of the slides, are about a third of an inch from the back. It's about the third or fourth presentation from the back, and there you can see some of the graphics in a little bit more detail because they are kind of hard to read from a distance after a while. But let's look at the legal framework for how to respond to computer intrusions. There's a lot of different ways that you can look at it. One way that's convenient to look at it to kind of give you a sense of what the framework is to break it down into actor-dependent categories, because the law, the way that the law is developed for the U.S., is very, very actor-dependent. In order for me to tell you what a proper legal response is or what your options are to a particular attack or intrusion on your system, you have to be able to tell me who the attacker is. Because I can't tell you it's lawful to go back and attack somebody, to use a cyber attack or a kinetic attack, unless you can tell me who that particular attacker happens to be. So and it breaks down, if you look at the vertical axis, into three categories. A state actor, where we have the most flexibility is a country to respond to a particular intrusion. A non-state, non-U.S. citizen actor is a category. And then, of course, a U.S. citizen. Now, this is perhaps an important perspective to look at from a U.S. domestic law perspective, because the constitutional protections to U.S. citizens, the legal authorities that we have depends upon who we are investigating at a given point in time. And there are different level of constitutional protections for those that are considered U.S. citizens as opposed to those non-state actors, to individuals, terrorists, criminals, hackers, that are not U.S. citizens. Okay, so it's a different set of legal authorities and protections. And then a state is a country, okay? The United States, England, France, Japan, China, a country, okay? Not to be confused with Alabama, Texas, or Virginia, or Nevada. So if you look at the horizontal axis, we look at kind of the context of are you in peacetime, are you in a point of crisis, or are you in a state of war? And if you look at this, the greatest flexibility for a country to respond to a particular intrusion is if it is a state actor and if it is during a point in time of armed conflict. So you have your greatest authority to respond at the top right of this particular graph. The way that the U.S. law enforcement community, the national security community, operates right now, our default environment, when we have somebody attack and penetrate a system, a U.S. government system, our default environment is to presume that it is a U.S. citizen, to afford the greatest constitutional protections for the hacker, the accused, the potential accused, and of course, fortunately, it's during peacetime. So our default environment is peacetime with a presumption that it is a U.S. citizen. Now, under international law that we'll see in a few minutes, peace and conflict are really the only two categories along that horizontal spectrum. But I added crisis because under U.S. domestic law, the President of the United States has a very, very wide range of emergency authorities during periods of crisis. And crisis is defined differently depending upon the particular statute that you look at. Yes, sir?
You talk about U.S. citizens. One of them is not a U.S. citizen, but a foreign expatriate. And I would assume if you look at different IP addresses, you're coming from an attack and they're overseas, you're expecting non-state or non-U.S. citizen, but yet they may still be a U.S. citizen.
The question deals with U.S. citizen. A U.S. citizen will have the same protections regardless of whether or not they're physically resident in the territory of the United States or overseas. There's a broader definition of U.S. citizen as well to include corporations as well as resident aliens within the territory of the United States. With respect to the second part of your question about IP addresses, when you look at a given attacker and you can identify an address that happens to be outside the territory or the jurisdiction of the United States, there is some evidence to show that the potential attacker may not be a U.S. citizen. But of course you don't know because of the number of hops that they may have gone through. They may have gone through any number of countries. So you never really know, at the beginning of an investigation, even though you have an IP address. If you have an IP address very quickly up front, then it's usually a very unsophisticated hacker or, on the other hand, somebody that is very sophisticated that's trying to throw you off track. But you never know whether or not it's a U.S. citizen or not. Yes, sir?
How do we define conflict? If I'm the security manager of a company, a large organization, and I see an attack from, as we say, IP addresses outside the country, I consider I'm in a conflict. Or at least a crisis.
We use the words attack and war and armed conflict in a wide variety of context. To look at it in the context of international law as activities between two states, where states are in conflict, then we'll get to that in a couple more slides. Okay, that is a very difficult question because there is no clear legal document, treaty, convention, statute, or anything that really defines what that is. We have 80-something definitions of aggression in the international community that is accepted at various degrees by different countries. It is very difficult to come to terms with what is aggression, what is a lawful attack, what is an unlawful attack, or what simply is an attack. And you have to look at attack with two different definitions. If somebody is in your network, they are attacking your network in the context of having penetrated your system without authority. But step back and look at it from an international law perspective to determine whether or not that is an attack under what we call the law of conflict management and would actually be, and this is not a legal term, but it is a very commonly used term that conveys the thought of an act of war. What is an act of war? Because war is not prohibited under international law. The use of force is prohibited under international law. And there's an important distinction that we'll get to in a few minutes. So any other comments on this slide? The important thing to take away from this slide is that it is very, very actor dependent. And of course, you know, attribution is one of the key issues. Who's breaking into your system? You don't know. And you're not going to know until some point in time that the investigation has began and through the course of the investigation. but you're not going to know what your full range of legal authorities are until you have identified who the attacker may or may not be. The presumption is that it's a U.S. citizen at this point in time. Okay. Any questions on this slide? Yes, sir. Very good question. Next slide. Because this answers your question. And the question dealt with what is the role of DOD in responding to an attack against privates? I'm paraphrasing quite a bit here. But what is the future role of DOD? What is the future role of the U.S. government in defending the infrastructure of America? Look at the legal structure from this perspective for a minute. And if I don't completely answer your question, then let me know. But there's a clear division here. You either have a state actor or you don't. You either have a person that is acting in his or her individual or some kind of collective private interest, a organized crime or a criminal or a hacker, a terrorist, drug runners. Those folks are individuals. They are not acting as a state like the United States. They're not acting as a state. Now, factually, this is very difficult to determine. Is the individual acting on their own motivation, or they're acting on behalf of the state, or are they acting in what they perceive to be in the interest of the state, but not necessarily for the state? The factual determination can be very difficult. But the legal perspective is actually quite simple, and is an easy way of looking at it. You either have a state actor, or you don't. Okay? A state actor is a national security community response, the intelligence community, the DOD community, the U.S. government as a whole. What kind of a law applies when you have a state actor that's involved? U.S. domestic law is always going to apply to a government agent. A government agent doesn't have the authority to do anything unless it is explicit or implicit in the statute or the Constitution of the United States. A government agent has to have implicit or explicit authority to act. So U.S. domestic law will always apply to DOD, to FBI, to any U.S. government agent. International peacetime regime, the Law of the Sea Convention, the telecommunications regulations, those types of peacetime regimes are going to apply to how states interact with each other. The law of conflict management is a part of international law that determines when a state uses force and crosses a line from what is a lawful activity to an unlawful use of force, to an act of war under international law. And then, of course, once you cross that threshold, which is very difficult to determine, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes, once you cross that threshold, another body of international law is going to apply, and that's the law of war, the law of armed conflict. That's going to apply to govern what the rules are for the combatants during that particular activity. So state actors is a national security community response, and there's a wide range of law that's going to apply. I don't have it listed here, but the foreign law of other countries may apply as well. You're not going to be concerned about the foreign law of a country that you're involved in an armed conflict with, but you may very well be concerned about the foreign law of neutral countries and other countries that your activities may have an impact on. Now, what if you don't have a state actor? You have a non-state actor. That is a law enforcement response. Now, that is very difficult to implement sometimes. It is very difficult, even in the United States, for the FBI to coordinate and cooperate with the state authorities of Virginia and the authorities of Texas and California because of the different cultures, the different jurisdictions, the different authorities, and the different time zones. And the U.S. is kind of seen to be kind of a corporate whole. Now, multiply that by 180-something countries around the world, the time zones, the different cultures, the different law enforcement jurisdictions. It may be a crime there, it may not be a crime there, it may be a crime here, it may not be. And a sophisticated hacker is going to go through a very, very wide range of countries just to try to throw you off and to make the investigation more difficult. But it's a law enforcement response. The difficulty of responding, or perhaps the impossibility of investigating, is tough, but it is still a law enforcement response. U.S. domestic law is still going to apply to those government agents. Foreign law is going to apply because you're trying to get another country to cooperate with you in the course of an investigation. Mutual legal assistance treaties. We have approximately 40 mutual legal assistance treaties, which are those treaties, either bilateral or multilateral, that we have with other countries that govern how our law enforcement will work with each other during the course of different types of investigations. Some of them are very, very specific and will only deal with certain types of crimes, and other ones are much broader, where there's a general obligation under the treaty to cooperate. The FBI has also set up 24-hour points of contact in 30-something different countries so that they have a way, a mechanism to try to investigate and start investigations very quickly and to preserve evidence and preserve the trail. The international peacetime regime is still going to apply as well. But what happens when you have a country that is unable to cooperate, or excuse me, unable to help you perform your investigation? All states have an obligation under international law. All states have an obligation under international law to prevent their territory from being used to the harm of another state. They have, in other words, an obligation to cooperate, to help you in good faith investigate.
That's where you use cruise missiles.
Well, we're getting to that because that's kind of in the red point. Okay. But remember, it's a law enforcement response. It may be difficult, but a state has a duty to cooperate in the law enforcement investigation. And the way for the state to cooperate in that type of investigation is to say, we don't have a computer crime network. We don't have an investigative capability. Will you help us? Will you send over some FBI agents or whoever the investigative authority is going to be to help us out? That is cooperating. Now, it may not mean that you're going to be able to identify who the criminal is, but they have satisfied their duty to cooperate when, in good faith, they ask for assistance and invite you in to try to help. Then you kind of have a situation where they say, we don't want to cooperate, or we want to cooperate, but it's not a crime in our country. So we're not going to let your people come in and investigate a crime because it's not a crime here. We want to cooperate, but we can't because it's not a crime. It's against our constitution or whatever the then we're kind of stuck in a lot of respects. You have a question?
Yes. Under which treaty is that stated that you are obligated to assist?
You have to look at the customary international law. The question is, under what treaty will you find this duty to cooperate? You will find under some of the mutual legal assistance treaties, that duty to cooperate in that bilateral, that multilateral context. So there may be some treaties there that will apply. You may have some extradition treaties that's kind of a broader than the mutual legal assistance treaties that may impose that duty or imply that duty to cooperate. But in a customary international law, it's very clear as well that you have the duty to cooperate because there have been a very wide range of cases that have gone to the International Court of Justice that have imposed civil liability and has recognized that particular. It's kind of, there's not a common law like we are accustomed to thinking of in here in the U.S. or in England, but there is a customary body of international law that is just as binding, and that's primarily where you find that duty, absence of mutual legal assistance treaty. Yes?
What organization is responsible for maintaining those statutes?
The treaties?
The
question is, what organization is responsible for maintaining the customary international law? And there isn't a given organization that is the repository of customary international law. Customary international law is reflected through the practice of states, and you have to do kind of a case study or heuristic analysis, which you'll see in a couple of slides when we try to answer your question about what is an act of war and what is lawful or unlawful is use of force in the international community. There isn't a clear answer. You have to look at the practice of states. So you go into documents of states to see how they responded to different particular activities, to a particular use of force over the years, to try to determine what is a use of force or what is customary law. You have to look at the practice of states. Now, the U.S. State Department has a digest of international law where they collect memorandums and opinions and things that reflect what is their particular opinion, legal opinion, or the U.S.'s legal position on various types of issues. Those types of documents you have to do your research to find out what is customary international law. But there isn't a repository as such for customary law. You will find it's very similar to case law, yes, that's correct. But you will find several documents, several books, several volumes that have summarized international law. And it will tell you if it's held by the great majority of states or who the dissenters are, who does not view it as customary law. So there's several research tools for you to help you determine what is the practice of states. But you have to look at the practice of states to determine what is customary international law. Yes, sir? I didn't hear quite the last part of the question. How do you determine civil and criminal liability for what? Okay, for one that can be used. How do you determine the civil and the criminal liabilities for having a sloppy network that other people can exploit to use against the harm of other people? U.S. tort law is going to do a very good job of that. If somebody penetrates my network and I'm able to determine, or the law enforcement is able to determine, that someone did it in another country, we may never know who that someone is, but we were able to determine that it's very easy and convenient for them to break into my system because of sloppy network administration, the failure to use best business practices in a given network that's here in the U.S. We can sue them in civil court under tort law for the cause that they have done to us. This is not a very clear area because best business practices is not very clear yet, has not been established. But we have already seen a couple of cases in the U.S. as well as multi-jurisdictional with other countries that involve that very thing. And you'll see in some of the recommendation slides at the end, I try to speculate whether or not we need regulation or statutes to help us push and do different things. And you'll see that one of the recommendations is that tort law and best business practices, the insurance community, is going to help bring best business practices home. And that's how you kind of determine that downstream liability. If your response, if you're talking about a response back, is kind of trying to track or hack back, then there may be some criminal implications as well as civil implications for you and your company. It's primarily a tort negligence analysis as opposed to a nuisance analysis. Although, if you're trying to put together a cause of action, you would list all possible, so the particular facts of a given case may give rise to a nuisance, but it's more of a tort negligence analysis than nuisance. That would seem to be kind of a very odd case to me. Yes, sir, right here.
If the nation state refuses to let in foreign law enforcement agencies, but states that it will use its own domestic law enforcement agencies to investigate, would that be considered
cooperation in good faith? The question is, what if they, and I kind of paused, as going through this to answer some questions, but that is absolutely correct. What we're looking for is how does a state in good faith cooperate with other countries to prevent their territory from being used to the harm of another country. If they say, we have crack computer hacker or computer crime investigators, we'll investigate it ourselves, and they do so in good faith, then they are fulfilling that obligation. Absolutely correct. Yes, sir.
What about the things like safeweb.com and other things like that? Other countries like China and other locations may have laws against going to certain sites, and they have set up firewalls and other things to prevent their own citizens from doing this. But other countries allow freedom of speech and all sorts of stuff, and they set up sites specifically to circumvent that country's foreign laws. Are those countries, like the United States, for example, would we be violating international law by allowing these internal websites, like safeweb.com, to operate? Because other countries, foreign law explicitly prohibits this.
Mm-hmm. You really get into kind of a complex area of conflict of jurisdiction and those types of issues there. But the question is primarily, what happens when you have a state such as China that prohibits or restricts access to the internet by its citizens and tries to control that very, very tightly? And other countries may do that as well. And then you have a company or an organization or perhaps even individual that has set up something that allows the citizens to circumvent their own law. I wouldn't suggest that that individual or those individuals affiliated with that company that allows that circumvention to perhaps take a vacation in that country anytime soon, because you could find yourself being prosecuted in that country as under any number of theories, such as actually being a principal to the crime, an accessory to the crime, or perhaps a co-conspirator. You could find a wide range of theories to prosecute in that particular country. But what if that country happens to be, or that company or individual happens to be in the United States, China or the country complains to the U.S., it's not a crime under our law, we cannot prosecute them. Then it's an issue of whether or not the diplomatic influence can persuade the U.S. to try to talk to them.
So could you potentially be forced to extradite those people to China?
You would have to look very closely at the extradition treaty. If it is not a crime under our law, that is generally an exception to extraditions, that we will not extradite people for an offense in another country that is not a crime in our country.
So the opposite being true, too. If it's a crime in the U.S., but not a crime, say, in Switzerland or someplace else, then that would be the same situation where we could not get extradition from someone in Switzerland or things because it wasn't a crime in their country.
That's correct. It's the same. The question dealt with extradition, and we cannot extradite one of our citizens to another country if it's not a crime under our law, and reciprocity is the same issue. That's correct. And you've been very patient. Yes, sir.
Do you know of any cases that have had a company in litigation as far as being liable as being used as redirect against national security or basically any other type of business hack or anything of that aspect because of their security network being vulnerable or liable to attack?
Except for the national security issue that you threw in there, you don't normally see the U.S. government taking that kind of a tort negligence activity against another country. Because first of all, you're looking at issues of sovereignty and whether or not you can even sue the other sovereign in the first place. The only jurisdiction in most respects for one country to sue another would be in the International Court of Justice, and that's not very clear. Now there is some case law in the U.S. Or some cases already that I've read about. I haven't read the opinions themselves that dealt with negligence issues, where especially in the case of distributed denial of service attacks, where a particular network or system was used to the detriment of another person. Anytime you do anything and it causes harm to someone else, and that other person can show negligence, then there's a possible cause of action there. You have to look at the statutes and everything.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's nothing we could do, obviously, but if they went into the national security or something for that aspect, mm-hmm. we're concerned that FBI or whoever could come into our company, grab what they want freely so that they can investigate, which would basically shut our company down.
The FBI doesn't have quite that broad range of authorities, but we'll get into some of that in a few minutes. Okay, and the question dealt with what's... You know, if your company is being used or being attacked and it's a national security issue, you still have the same constitutional protections as if it was simply a crime. I'll take one more question, then we'll have to move forward a little bit. Yes, sir.
And your chart would indicate that the jurisdiction of the response is a function of who's attacking. But if the target were, say, a U.S. military network, would it matter who's attacking?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. The question is that the previous graphic would suggest that your course of action depends upon who the attacker is as to what your course of action is. Does it make any difference if it's a U.S. military computer system that is being attacked as to whether or not it's a law enforcement or national security issue? And because of the presumption that it's a U.S. citizen and it's a peacetime situation, it is a law enforcement issue. Until that point in time that you can determine that it's another country that is doing it, then just because you determine that it's another country doesn't mean that you can necessarily respond in with the use of force. Okay, but it, when we had the hackers break in back in early 1998, the two teenagers from California with the Israeli mentor, the DoD General Counsel and the Secretary of Defense called up the FBI. It was a law enforcement issue, and it was coordinated by the NIPC. And they found the hackers after about a week and a half or 2 weeks, and then they watched them for about another week and a half or 2 weeks to determine who else was involved in everything. But if it is a military target, it can still be a law enforcement issue. What if it's a teenager in Northern Virginia that's breaking into it? It's still a law enforcement issue until you determine who the attacker is. Okay. There's kind of several prongs to the last one that we need to cover real quick, then move on. State has a duty to cooperate. They can do so in a number of ways. If they refuse to cooperate, then you have to kind of step back and determine how much pain they're causing or that the terrorist or the particular organization is causing you. If it is important enough to our national security, let's say we have a terrorist or a criminal that is breaking into our command and control system, our early warning missile defense system, our national missile defense system, and this could be really dangerous to us, and the state sits over there and says, we're not going to do a thing, we refuse to believe your evidence that there's a terrorist in our country that's breaking into your system. We refuse to believe that. A state never loses its right of self-defense under international law. At some point in time, we would have to craft a theory, because it is a law enforcement response. Once we determine that it is an individual in another country that's not acting on behalf of the state, but is now being protected, harbored by a state, then we have to come up with a theory of conspiracy, of accessory after the fact, or simply just the state, they're harboring the terrorist, and we take action. And you can do so with a cyber response as well as with a kinetic response. Look at a situation very similar to this under a legal analysis when our embassies were bombed in sub-Saharan Africa a couple of years ago, and Sudan and Afghanistan refused to cooperate with the law enforcement investigations and actually arresting Osama bin Laden. And we used kinetic force, cruise missiles that somebody referred to a while ago, to respond in self-defense to take out that particular threat. In that particular case, it was a theory of anticipatory self-defense. Okay, so the question is, what is appropriate and a lawful response when a territorial state says, to hell with you, I'm not helping, I don't believe your evidence, or yes, but we're not going to do anything because it's not a crime under our law. We don't lose our right of self-defense. Are we going to attack kinetically or even a cyber attack if they're breaking into a military television system that runs cartoons on Saturday morning for dependents overseas? Probably not. If they're breaking into the early warning missile defense system and there's a real threat there, probably so. Yes, sir. No. Yeah. From a legal analysis, there is not a distinction under international law if we determine that it's Iran or Iraq or China or France or Britain or Canada there is no distinction from purely a legal analysis. As a political and a practical matter, however, if you have somebody that's kind of a pariah in the international community, such as Iraq either is or was at some point in time recently in the past because of their invasion of Kuwait, then, you know, that's kind of a subjective perspective. There were other countries who didn't think that Iraq was an invader or was violating international law at that point in time. But as a practical effect, if you do something that a lot of the countries don't like in the first place, then there's not as much international objection to it. Okay, let's move on to the third perspective. We're still kind of looking, next slide, at determining how does the law apply. So the law is, what law is applicable is going to depend upon a wide range of things. If you have a government actor, a U.S. government actor, or if you have somebody in the territory of the United States that is engaging in some kind of activity in cyberspace, then U.S. domestic law is always going to apply to what is happening at that point in time. There's a the U.S. domestic law is always going to apply. Next slide. International law is going to apply if you cross borders. If your activity in cyberspace is going to cross a national border, international law is going to apply. And there are three bodies of international law that I've listed there that we're going to talk about in a little bit more detail. Next slide. Telecommunications law is kind of a subset of international law and the domestic laws of other countries, but it's an important aspect to look at when you're looking at responding in cyberspace, because most likely telecommunications law is going to apply under most circumstances under international law when you are doing something in cyberspace. And it really varies where you're engaging your activity from in the first place and what platforms you're using. Is your activity in the United States? Or are you on the high seas? Or are you in the international airspace? Or are you in the territory of another country? Or are you in their exclusive economic zone? Or are you in their territorial seas? All those kinds of issues of where you are when you engage in this may invoke the application of different laws there. Next slide. Telecommunications law and foreign law, if you're going through the internet, again, there's not a body of law called the internet law, but there is a wide range of laws that are invoked and have evolving applications to the internet that you have to look at. So if you're using the internet as opposed to a straight satellite hookup or system, then that's something that you need to kind of consider. Next slide. Host nation law. What if the United States is launching an attack against Iraq from the sovereign territory of Saudi Arabia? Do we have to have that country's permission to do so? The United States military cannot even have a court-martial or administrative judicial punishment in the territory of another country without that country's permission, because that is a governmental act within the sovereign territory of another country. Now, having said that, the question is, do we have to have another country's permission to launch an offensive attack against another country from their territory? Clearly so. So if you have aircraft taking off from an airstrip, that's really easy for the host nation to tell, and you have to have their permission. What if you have combat electrons taking off? The host country can't tell, but it may be tracked back. The legal analysis is the same. You still have to have that country's permission to launch an offensive attack from their territory. Yes? Probably all of them. You're going to have the laws of the U.S. that's going to apply. You're going to have the laws of that particular country that is going to apply where the activity is occurring. And you will have some of the, you may have some of the telecommunications, the internet is going to apply as well. So you have to look at all of them. But when you're looking at trying to figure out what law applies to bring some kind of a cause of action, you're going to primarily look at not the international law, but the domestic law of the country where the act is occurring, or the domestic law of the country where the harm has occurred. So that's primarily, there may be a number of other laws that apply that they may be violating or they may not be violating. But if you're looking at trying to bring a cause of action against them for some harm they've caused, then you'll primarily look at the law of the territory where the harm has occurred or where the offensive act has occurred, the criminal act has occurred. And you have to decide where you most likely recover from. Okay. Next slide. Law of the Sea. There's a wide range of things under the Law of the Sea Convention, for example, that may impact a government that's on board a warship that wants to engage in information operations, information warfare. States, for example, have to... A state's warship has the authority to pass through the 12-mile territorial sea of another country if it is doing so in innocent passage. What is innocent passage? The Law of the Sea Convention will tell you about 19 examples of what innocent passage is not. Intelligence collection is one of them. Harmful interference with the telecommunications infrastructure, if you're engaging information operations, for example, would not be innocent passage. If you're launching an offensive operation from that shipboard platform or from an airborne platform in the territory sea of another country, then that law may apply. And this is simply to try to kind of give you a sense of going through this, that there's a wide range of law that's out there. What you're doing may invoke the application of that law. It may not prohibit what you're doing. It may, in fact, permit what you're doing. But you need to consider where you're at, what you're doing, what platforms you're using, are you in the U.S., are you in another country, to determine what the applicable law may be. Yes, sir?
So the spy plane in China was definitely in international waters when it went through and was eavesdropping.
Well, that was a factual question. I don't know. But, I mean, the question is, the spy plane, the EP-3, was definitely in international airspace.
We wouldn't go into somebody's airspace and eavesdrop, would we?
As a general proposition, we would not.
Yeah.
Okay, and the reason that we would not is if we do so, other countries would have the same right to do so because we start creating state practice and activities in international law and customary law. So
echelon
is too complicated to answer right now. Okay. But what about echelon? Very, very quickly, if the US is doing something within the legal restrictions that it has, then that's permissible. If England and several other countries are doing things that are permissible under their laws, then that is obviously lawful activity. The fact that all five countries get together and do so in concert, that is still lawful activity. But then you have to consider what is the impact of the foreign law of where they are at. Are they actually in another country collecting that law, or are they simply sitting out in international space collecting the radiation, the EM radiation? Espionage is lawful under international law. Espionage is lawful under international law. How do we deter espionage? We deter espionage by making it a crime under the domestic law of the state against which is being spied. That is a very easy thing to do from some perspectives. When you pre-internet, if somebody wanted to steal something, they had to be physically present to come in and to steal it. Now you have some interesting issues of deterrence, but espionage is lawful under international law. And let's just kind of leave echelon at that point, to where we'll never get anywhere in the next 15 minutes. Okay, one more question, and then I'm going to hold off all questions and speed through.
Hey, you were talking about it mattered where the combat electrons took off from, like say from Saudi attacking Iraq. Well, if the cyber retaliation actually initiated in the U.S., but went through intervening countries, which it almost certainly would you have to get permission from every one of those intervening countries? If it just went through routers in their country, say the router in Saudi Arabia was the next to last before it hit Iraq, would we have to have permission from Saudi Arabia?
That is, I think, the question is, okay, so you launch combat electrons from a given country, and that means that you have to ask that country's particular permission to do so. What happens when you are simply transiting the telecommunications infrastructure of another country? Their law is going to apply. And how is that? that's kind of where your cyber analogy to the physical world breaks down a little bit, because under the telecommunications regulations, you have, it's not a prohibition. Now, one of the principles of international law is that which is not prohibited is permitted, because there is no supranational authority that tells states what the law is and what they're bound to be. A state can only be bound to international law if it agrees to be bound, or if it's done so through state practice over a long period of time. So that is not very clear. If we're saying we have aircraft flying over the airspace of another country, such as the attack on Libya, you clearly have to get that country's permission to do so. And we had several countries that denied permission over the years for us to be able to do that kind of thing. In this kind of a context, if there is not going to be any harm done, and you don't really know that ahead of time, but generally speaking, it's probably not going to be prohibited, and you're not going to have to get that country's permission, is the way that the law is most likely going to develop. Okay. Okay, let's hold off on the questions for a while, because we have 15 minutes left, and I think I'm still on my introductory slides. But that's okay. You all have had some very good questions so far. Next slide. Air law, foreign law, I think you've got the picture now. It really depends upon where you're at, what you're doing, as to what law is going to apply. One more. The law of the target state. If you're in armed conflict, do you care what the law of the target state is? I don't think so. But what if you're in peacetime? Do you care what the law of the foreign state is? Of course you do. You may not... You may have to do something that violates that law under presidential permission or findings to do so, but you would care under, it does have a greater impact during peacetime than it would during armed conflict. Next slide. Okay, what are some of the key legal issues under U.S. domestic law? And I'm going to talk real fast and see if we can't give you, what I want to do is to kind of give you a very high-level overview of some of the issues so you kind of have a sense of what the issues are, and then try to rush to the case studies, which are probably about 10 slides from here. Attribution is always going to be an issue. Property rights, privacy issues, confidentiality, civil liberties. The FBI simply cannot come in, and just because it's a national security issue and seize everything, they still would have to have court orders, warrants to do so. What are some of the criminal and civil liabilities? Posse Comitatus says that the Department of Defense cannot act as law enforcement within the territory of the United States. So what is going to be the role of DOD in the future for protecting our infrastructure? It will evolve, and we're going to have to consider the implications of this particular law. Right now, we have separate legal authorities for the military, for the law enforcement, and for our foreign intelligence activities, but we're going to have to do something that merges those three when we are doing some cyber investigations. And then, of course, we talked about the presumption that the intruder is a U.S. citizen until proven otherwise. Why not have a presumption that it is not a U.S. citizen until we determine otherwise? And what's the worst case scenario? It is, in fact, a U.S. citizen. We've collected evidence against them that is going to be excluded from court and prosecuting them. But for certain systems that are vital to our national security and our existence, we may want to have that reverse presumption. It's better to protect those systems and not be able to prosecute an individual than allow an individual to cause harm to us that we're not going to be able to determine who it is or what's happening quick enough. Next slide. Key legal issues under international law. Are you in peacetime? Are you in armed conflict? The use of force. If you determine that it is another state and that they are committing an unlawful use of force against you and you have the right of self-defense, your use of force in response still must be necessary and proportional, and it must be discriminate. Necessary and proportional and discriminate. A hostile act and hostile intent. You work for the private industry in the private sector. You do something and you counterattack, and another country perceives that coming from a U.S. IP address as a hostile act or a demonstration of hostile intent, and they respond by attacking one of our warships or attacking the territory of the U.S. Have they engaged in a lawful act of self-defense? They're trying to argue so. So you have to... These are issues that, even though you're not a government actor, you might want to be aware of and consider how your actions... What about the PRC-US hacker wars after the EP3 was landed on the island? Could that be considered an act of a state? Could that have invoked hostilities? How much law enforcement cooperation are we going to have between the U.S. and China when you have strained relations to begin with? Probably not a whole lot. Next slide. What are some of the key legal issues under foreign law? We talked about sovereignty and governmental acts. One state cannot engage in a governmental act within the sovereign territory of another country without that country's permission. What is the exception to this? And I'll give the T-shirt to the non-lawyer who can answer this question. What is the exception to that under U.S. law that also applies to any country? Yes, sir?
Hot pursuit.
Hot pursuit is not the right answer. Child pornography is not the right answer. When can we violate the sovereignty of another country? During an act of war, that's correct. But more specifically, during peacetime. Give us a hint. Okay, I'll give you the answer. We had one more person here. When, a little bit more specific. Okay, that's close enough. We cannot violate the sovereign territory under international law without that country's permission. But what happens, what is espionage? What is a covert operation when we have a presidential finding that allows the SEALs to go in, or the military to go in, or for the intelligence community to go into another country? Is that a violation of their law? It clearly is. But we can do that anyway under our law, and any other country can do that as well, because under international law, espionage is lawful. So you can come and get your T-shirt after the presentation. And besides, you should have read the slides. The answer is the very last bullet. Okay. Next slide. Selected legal authorities, we simply don't have the time to go through all of this. If you are really interested in looking at what the FBI, somebody had a question over here about the FBI coming into your company. If you are really interested in learning a little bit more detail about what the law enforcement authorities and investigations are for the FBI or for any state or local authorities, I would encourage you to go to the Department of Justice's website, look for the Computer Crime and Intellectual Property section, and they have a handbook. It's about 160 pages. They have a handbook, which is really an easy read. You don't have to have gone to law school to understand this stuff. I mean, the law is relatively simple. If you can understand technology and this other stuff, the law is a simple thing for you to read through and to understand. You have to go to law school to practice law. You don't have to go to law school to understand the law necessarily. But if you're interested in this, what you're looking for is the Computer Crime Handbook that the FBI has. Let me see very quickly if I have the website. You're looking for, it's about a 160-page manual. It's dated January of 2001, and it's entitled Searching and Seizing Computers and Obtaining Electronic Evidence in Criminal Investigations. It's a very, very easy read, and will give you a very good overview of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, as well as the wiretap statutes, the PIN registers, and those statutes that the FBI have to abide by when they're investigating U.S. citizens. It's a very easy read, very good overview. The next couple of slides were intended to kind of give you an overview of that, but we don't have the time to do that because we've had some really good questions so far. But you do have the slides in the book that'll kind of give you a high-level overview. And if you would like more detail, then simply go to the Department of Justice website for the CCIPS, Computer Crime and Intellectual Property section, and look for their handbook on computer crime. And it will give you an excellent overview of that. Three areas of international law. You're talking about the peacetime regime. It does not prohibit activities in cyberspace, but it may restrict what is happening. The law of conflict management, and I'm sorry, but we're not going to be able to get in much detail to your question about what is the use of force in cyberspace. But it is a heuristic analysis. You have to look at state practice to determine what is going to be lawful or unlawful. And we can talk about it during the break or something if you like in more detail. And then the use in bello is the law of war. You know, once you are engaging in conflict, there are an additional set of rules that govern the protection of combatants and non-combatants and how you
authorized to engage in conflict. What does that say? PowerPoint found an error. Okay, who cares? Well, there's actually a little bit more to that slide, believe it or not, and you can find it in your handouts. I thought we were going to make it through this without technical glitch. What this slide was intended to do was to kind of go through a more detailed analysis of when do you cross that line. And there are two bodies of law that you have to look at to help determine when you have unlawfully used force, either kinetically or in cyberspace, under international law. The basic rule is under the Charter of the United Nations, which every country in the world is a member of, you are prohibited from using force or threatening to use force against the territorial integrity or the political independence of another country or in any way that's inconsistent with the purpose and the principles of the Charter of the United Nations. That is the rule that you have to try to interpret. What is the use of force under international law? And this slide was to try to kind of explain the application of international law. And we have another... Okay, it's going to be stubborn. Wow. Okay, let's see if we can very quickly recover something here. There we go. This was examples of applications of the law that might apply out there. You can read through those. Next slide, please. This is your heuristic analysis. This is your case study. This is intended to map out what the law of conflict management is, what those thresholds are, and to tell you in blue what activities have been determined in the past as case law to have violated or not to have violated the use of force analysis. And again, this is, I use this slideshow for an 8-hour workshop, so it's kind of hard to give you much of a detail in an hour. Next slide, sorry. I'm usurping his authority. And the bottom half of that particular chart will tell you what your lawful response is. Next slide. And we have about 5 minutes left, so let's go straight to the case studies. Because we've covered, this is kind of a flow chart that's intended to summarize everything we've talked about so far. This is kind of how I would analyze a legal issue if you're asking me if a particular activity in cyberspace was lawful or unlawful. And it just, this summarizes everything that we've talked about so far about looking at U.S. domestic law, looking at international law, looking for law of another country, and what some of the exceptions that happens to be in case you are in armed conflict or some of the other exceptions actually that we haven't even had the chance to talk about yet. Next slide. Okay, case studies, track back. What can you do within your own system? If you look at the Electronic Communications Privacy Act and a couple of the other statutes, it gives you user and system owner authorities to protect your system, not to investigate, not to prosecute, but to protect your system. So whatever you do to track back using honeypot or whatever, as long as you remain within the system that you have ownership or authority over, you can do a wide range of things and have a very wide range of flexibility. What can you read everybody's email? Can you trace what they're doing? That all is going to depend upon your company policy and how you've set that up. What about shooting back? What if it's external to your system or to your network? If you look at the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, that's explained in some detail in the FBI's Computer Crime Handbook. There's a chart at the end of the discussion that summarizes when a particular activity, depending upon how they're defined under the law, must or may release information to law enforcement or to other individuals, and whether or not that you have to have a warrant or voluntary disclosure is permissible. Okay, shoot back. Attribution is the biggest issue. I've had a lot of people say, I want to attack back. Is it lawful? Well, who is it you want to attack? I don't know. Well, I mean, attribution is a key issue. You have to tell me who you want to attack before I can tell you whether or not it's lawful. When you're targeting them under international law, your use of force has to be necessary, proportional, and discriminant. Somebody attacks you through cyberspace. They attack you with the electrons. They penetrate your network. It's considered a use of force under international law. Can you respond kinetically with steel on target, with cruise missiles? Absolutely. If you have the right of self-defense, you have the right to use all otherwise lawful measures to defend yourself. You may be attacked with electrons through cyberspace, but if you have the right of self-defense under international law, and if your response is necessary and proportional, then you may attack using the military, kinetic weapons, or whatever. And I say you, that obviously connotes state activity and not to a private company there. Okay. Okay, next slide. DirecTV satellite entertainment. You can kind of read through this a little bit, but there, it's a satellite company that has the same problem that most service providers have, and that's theft of services. There was an interesting article that came out a while back that talked about information warfare attacks, counterattacks. They released a worm. They went out there and they killed the hackers. But what do? It's a proprietary system. Everything that they did was that they put small pieces of code slowly into the key that you have to have to get access, and then they deactivated all of those that were not authorized. They never left their own proprietary system. Perfectly lawful. And note, one of the things that they did not do is to attack the computers that were being used to emulate their card so that they could steal services. Because what? That was not part of their proprietary system. So very carefully planned out, very lawful, very effective. Next case study. Rights of law enforcement to cross national borders. Iran or Iraq has broken into your network and they're looking for evidence of crimes in their country. Is that lawful? Well, somebody said yes. Perhaps not. There was a case not too long ago that we just, the opinion itself just came out in May, I think it was. The FBI set up a sting operation, perfectly lawful operation. They had two people that were suspected hackers. They invited them in for a job opportunity, for a job interview. Hey, show us what you can do. So they said, and we want to watch you. So they sit down, they access their computers back in Russia. The FBI watched, got the passwords, the account numbers, and the computers. And then they went back in, downloaded evidence. Okay, was that lawful? Next slide. The U.S. federal court judge held that they had no expectation of privacy. There is a good explanation of what an expectation of privacy is and to what extent you have it as a government employee and as a private sector employee in that computer crime handbook. Very good explanation. But what you have to be careful is the headlines to this particular article that says, judge authorizes FBI to hack Russian computers. That's not what the judge did at all. The judge had a very narrow ruling that what the FBI did not violate the Fourth Amendment rights of these two individuals, of these two accused, of this one, because it was just one individual was being prosecuted in this case. So, what does this case say about the rights of the FBI to break into computers in Russia, or the rights of the Iranian or Russian or any other country's law enforcement to break into your private sector computer system? Doesn't say a thing. Doesn't say a thing at all. It simply says that what the FBI did was not a violation of this particular accused privacy rights under the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution of the United States. That's all it says. So be careful when you read the headlines. Judge says FBI can hack foreign computers. It's not what the judge said at all. Okay. Why is it any more lawful for a state or an organization to break into your computer than it is for an individual? It isn't. Why is it any more lawful for you to break into somebody else's computer trying to figure out who's breaking into yours? It isn't. It's still a trespass. It's still a property violation under law. Next slide. These are some legal and policy considerations I'll skip. Next slide. I think they're self-evident if you go through that. We are out of time, so I won't be offended if you leave. What the last couple of slides do is ask you a question, and we've covered a lot of these already during the course of the presentation. But it will ask you, it asks the question of how can we better protect Americans' information infrastructure. And I think it's kind of self-evident. If you're interested, you can kind of read through those. But how can we shape, if we don't know who the attacker is, you know, how can we shape a better effective response? What's an appropriate and lawful response when the territorial state is unwilling or unable? We've talked about that some. Next slide. How does America protect technology, policy, and law? It's not, somebody made the point, it ain't just a firewall. You have to have good policies and you have to have good law. The law is going to trail. You have to have a good policy in your company that will go a long way combined with the technology to provide good security for your company. And if you provide good security for your company and everybody else does the same, then we effectively will build a secure infrastructure within the United States. How can the private sector better protect America's information infrastructure? These are, I think, intuitive. So, next slide. How can the government help? What is the role of DOD? Somebody asked that question earlier. What's the potential role of the U.S. government and DOD in protecting your computer system? That is evolving. I think you will see an institution that's going to be responsible for protecting our infrastructure in the United States, where you will have someone else responsible for protecting your computer network, in addition to you being responsible for that as well. Next slide. And that is it. So thank you very much for your time and your patience. I'll answer any questions during the break, and then as somebody else begins outside in the hallway afterwards. So thanks for coming by. And, this is a lot better than a legal conference. I didn't have to wear a tie.